From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, policing the racial divide and how to close it on the streets of Boston.
It's just a festering wound in the U.S. culture, U.S. history that, you know, won't heal until there's real change.
Plus, tuition and fees on the rise again at UMass. It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today, New England Republicans on Donald Trump's pick for VP, Indiana Governor Mike Pence.
We're ready to put a fighter and a patriot in the Oval Office of the United States of America. We're ready for Donald Trump to be our next president.
And Life Animated, Ron Suskind's incredible story of how Disney characters provided the key for his severely autistic son to rejoin his family and the world.
That was the moment we said, oh my God, there's a world in there. So the question was, how do you get back in?
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This show originally aired earlier today.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to start today with our Week in Review, beginning with reaction to last night's horrific attack on Bastille Day celebrations in Nice, France. We just heard President Obama extending his sympathies to the French people and proclaiming his determination to stand with them and to continue to fight and to defeat ISIS, the president said. As we've been reporting, during celebrations last night in the southern French city of Nice, a truck barreled down a boulevard packed with people watching Bastille Day fireworks, killing at least 84 of them, including children, and injuring dozens more. There's a lot we still don't know about the motivation behind the killings, but French authorities identified the attacker as a 31-year-old Tunisian-born man who was shot dead by French police. The French government will extend a state of emergency that's been in place since the November 13th attacks in and around Paris. Here's President François Hollande speaking through a translator.
This terrorist attack is once again a very violent act, an absolutely violent act, and it is quite clear that we must do everything to fight against the scourge of terrorism.
At the White House today, President Obama said this fight will be won by staying true to American values, including democracy and diversity, and called efforts to bar Muslims from the U.S. repugnant, and said we cannot give in to fear or be divided by religion, because that is what the terrorists want, according to the president. We turn now to John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communication. He's also senior news analyst here at WBUR. John, good to have you.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, a Boston-based think tank. Hello, Jim. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
Sorry that we have to start on such a sad day for the French people, indeed a sad day for so many of us. John, I'll start with you. Reactions, first of all, to what you heard the president just saying.
It sounded very much like sort of a bookend to the Dallas Memorial speech he gave earlier in the week. Very much about unity, very much about the forces lined up against society, very much about coming together, and sort of a laundry list of the power of diplomacy. I think he wandered a little far afield there. Climate change, Burma. I'm not sure that that really suited the occasion all that well. But I think that what he was saying was, this is a situation where people have to come together, a situation where people have to be vigilant. The problem is, who anticipates someone driving a semi-truck down what was very similar to the Esplanade on 4th of July?
It really is a tricky quandary, Jim. You know, we talk about asymmetrical warfare and all kinds of defenses that the West puts up. But as John said, a truck. It was full of guns and grenades, but they weren't used. And what havoc he was able to create.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Look, the context of this speech the president gave was probably in front of diplomats, from what we can tell. I don't know the context of it directly, but clearly he was speaking to diplomats. That's why he raised a whole bunch of issues that were a little far afield: Ebola, Cuba, and as John was saying, even climate change. I would also say, look, I think as you, the important context here is the United States has been decimating lands, that areas that are territory that's been held by ISIS, and I understand the president's desire not to talk about it straight on and actually recognize verbally the opponent as directly as he might. But I'd say a couple things that struck me as good and bad in this speech. One is restating freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. These are things that tie us to the French, and they're important to restate in the context of a speech like this. Where I lost him was connected to chronic violence in the United States. And you could see it in two places where he said, you know, there are impulses that exist in all of our countries, and then we will be relentless against the terrorists, almost back to back. And it shows how conflicted he is and how he might speak about this. And it's a difficult thing to do. Now, on your direct question of how do you defend against this, I think there one thing we do have a question about is what were the preparations there for? How would you actually allow a truck there? And there should have been something there to some sort of defense against having that kind of vehicle, which was prohibited, by the way, from that area, to get into that area. So,
yeah, from what we understand, this truck was pretty much able to roll right from Nice right onto this pedestrian esplanade. And given that France was under a state of emergency and has been for the last couple of weeks, I mean, it's a fair question to ask, even though Monday morning quarterbacking in such situations is difficult. But it is a fair question to ask how that truck was able to roll into that area given that celebration. Yeah. What do you think, John?
I think that's true. And I think there are going to be a lot of questions that come up before this is resolved. Ironically, the state of emergency was about to be lifted until Hollande reimposed it. I have to say about Barack Obama, one of the most maddening things to his critics is his, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach to virtually everything. You know, we saw this in Dallas. We will probably see it here. The sort of the even-handedness of Barack Obama, which is really constitutional, I think, is something that that in many ways reduces the impact.
Yeah. Well, I want to, speaking of Dallas, let's just listen back to this week, because I want to go back and actually talk about some local news and talk about the issue of police shootings and violence and efforts to close that racial gap. But, John, because you brought up Dallas, I want to talk about that memorial service on Tuesday of five officers killed in Dallas. Here's President Obama speaking at that service.
I have spoken at too many memorials during the course of this presidency. I've hugged too many families who've lost a loved one to senseless violence. And I've seen how a spirit of unity born of tragedy can gradually dissipate, overtaken by the return to business as usual.
So I wanted to play that, John, because you brought up that speech. And I'll start with you, Jim. But again and again and again, the president, as presidents often are, put in this role as consoler in chief. But President Obama has been doing this a lot lately, sadly, for many of us. But how do you think he did in Dallas dealing with this issue this week?
Well, I think he did very well. I mean, I think there were parts of the speech where he said things like this. If we cannot talk honestly and openly, not just in the comfort of our own circles, but with those who look different than us or bring a different perspective, then we will never break this dangerous cycle. And that's absolutely to point, and that is the secret sauce, if you will. So, you know, there was lots of talk about should he have raised the issue of Glocks versus books and all that. And I get that. I mean, that's probably didn't belong there. But overall, I think he did a very good job.
Yeah. John?
I thought it was a national Rorschach test. People who came to it sympathetic to Barack Obama thought it was moving, thought it was unifying, said there are echoes of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln. Those who normally opposed Barack Obama saw it as political opportunism, where essentially he used what should have been a tribute to the fallen officers as a place to further his political agenda. And I think very much, you know, how you came to this speech was how you left this speech. And I think, again, you know, that's one of the characteristics of Obama is he does create that rift in the reactions. If you followed it on Twitter, it was amazing how polarizing it was.
Well, speaking of polarizing, I want to shift gears and bring this a little closer to home, to Boston and to Massachusetts.
Back up, back up. We want freedom.
So sound there from Wednesday night when some 2,000 people marched in demonstrations in Roxbury protesting police violence. This follows the police shootings earlier this month in Baton Rouge in Minnesota of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, as well as the ambush and murder of five police officers in Dallas, which we were just talking about a moment ago. But here's rally organizer Brock Satter of the group Mass Action Against Police Brutality.
There. It just shows how deep the discontent really is. You know, it hasn't expressed itself completely, you know. It's just a festering wound in the U.S. culture, U.S. history that, you know, won't heal until there's real change.
So a festering wound, talk there of the need for real change. A new poll out today from the group Mass Inc. and the Boston Foundation found that almost half of respondents think Boston faces some of the same feelings of distrust between law enforcement and minorities among African Americans. The poll puts that number at about 60%. Jim, what's your take on how this is playing out locally here in Boston, this issue?
Well, you know, there's, I think locally, at least in the conversations I've had with people who deal with policy, one of the things that happened over the last week I think is pretty important is Roland Fryer's report actually came out. Roland is actually here at Harvard. He's on the Board of Education, happily. He's a very smart guy and has tried to take a dispassionate look into this. And it's one of the most in-depth looks that we've had. It did not deal with Boston per se, but it did shed light on how you can have a conversation about it without either falling on one side or the other. And that is just to say, where do we see bias? Mm-hmm. Where do we see less bias? With which officers do we see bias in what areas? And I think that's the kind of conversation we have to have. I'd say the second piece that I think plays locally is this. This plays directly in the conversation about body cameras. And I think this community is in the place where, even though we have not had the kind of violence we've seen elsewhere recently, I think among the people I talk to, and I talk broadly with people, not just in policy circles, but body cameras they see as a good thing. We would not be where we are as a country in terms of understanding what this issue is without cell phone cameras and without body cameras to some degree. And I think we're well along the way to doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on that score, this week, Boston announced that they've reached a deal, city officials have, with the police union to have 100 officers wear body cameras in a six-month pilot program that could start as early as next month. John, sounds like a good idea to you?
It sounds like a good idea. It's one that's been gestating for a while. Yeah. It's been almost a year they've been talking about this. And one of the problems that critics raise is that it's voluntary. So it's going to be a self-selecting group of police officers that may not be representative, really, of the force as a whole. There are also issues about when the officers can actually view the video of an incident. Can they view it? And they can before they file their official statements. Does that color how they present what happened on the street, what was or was not on camera? All those things. It's not that they can't be straightened out. It's not that the privacy issues can't be dealt with. But I don't see Boston moving as aggressively and as quickly as a number of people would like it to.
Let me ask you about a couple of other proposals that we heard this week. In terms of what can be done to close that sense of sort of racial division on the streets. State Representative Russell Holmes is chairman of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus. He spoke on WBUR this morning and called for changes in police training. Here's a bit of what he said.
Well, one of the biggest improvements we want to see is something called police officer standards and training. And one of the reasons why is because you don't want a bad police officer to move from one police department to another. So that way you can then have it so that folks can understand they have a standard they have to adhere to at all times.
And he also talked about establishing a system of special prosecutors rather than elected district attorneys to take charge of police-involved shootings. Jim, your thoughts on those kinds of proposals?
Well, you know, these are proposals that Black Lives Matters, as well as to some degree on the standard side, the president's panel on policing has put forward. What I'd say is this. I was about to say we also, on top of cameras, we absolutely need more training. And mm-hmm. the way I think about this is, again, to go back to Fryer's research, what is clear is that police touch, push, shove black individuals more than they will other races. Well, there has to be absolutely training applied there. I think on the one of the key issues around building trust is if there's no transparency, and that's why we want body cameras, people want more transparency. We have a culture of omerta, of basically saying, look, blue stands with blue, black stands with black. And that's the fault line here. And I think to some degree, I think it's well worth considering whether we have a third party come in and evaluate all shootings. Who that is, I'm not sure, should be elevated to a federal level. I'm not sure it should be elevated beyond what we currently have, but we should certainly look at how that is done right now, because there isn't a sense of trust because of that lack of openness.
Yeah, and I guess leaving the investigations in the hands of the district attorney, for example, they work very closely with police. No one is necessarily going to accuse them of not being capable of being impartial, but there's certainly a perception, right, that that's going to be a problem. John, what do you think?
I think perception is the key here, because how different groups perceive this situation overall is something that leads to different conclusions and different senses of urgency.
Right.
The survey just came out that found that more people had very serious concerns about violence against the police than violence by the police. That kind of perception gap is something that stands in the way of making progress in many ways, because you don't have this sense of a unified public opinion that, number one, what the problem is, and number two, what the potential solutions are, and number three, how quickly they should be implemented. And because of that split, I think that things move along much more slowly and much more tentatively than they might otherwise.
Well, really vexing issues at the end of a really difficult week around these issues. But so I want to move on and talk about rising tuition and fees at the University of Massachusetts and the University of Massachusetts system. Yesterday, trustees voted to boost tuition and fees by 5.5%, the third time in 6 years that tuition and fees have gone up. It would amount to about $800 more per student. UMass says the increase is to fill an $85 million budget gap, which wasn't filled by the state legislature. Jim Sturgis, I know that this is an issue near and dear to your heart. I'd love to get your reaction.
So
where are we at with this?
Where are we at with this? So the first thing is the state budget did only increase it by about 1% for the University of Massachusetts. So that did put more pressure on the university system. Second thing is the 800 on average number that you just talked about, that is an average.
Yeah.
So out-of-state students will pay more and in-state students will pay less, and that's also a good thing. And one of the reasons why it's a good thing is this. Out-of-state students pay about $31,000. They go up to about $32,000. The fact is, a lot of them get merit scholarships. Probably on average, they're going to pay about $27,000. But educating them costs almost $40,000 a head. Mm-hmm. So you see UMass is playing a bit of a cash flow game here, where they go after out-of-state students to fund the university because they perceive themselves as not receiving enough funding. They are undertaking capital projects, building $7 billion of new capital infrastructure. Their debt service is spiraling out of control. And what I'm trying to say here, in short, is this. Tuition increases are going to continue because we built a model for this university system which is unsustainable over the long period, to the point where, on top of all the issues I just mentioned, you have a deferred maintenance backlog of about $3.5 billion. It's getting to be like the T.
I want to play a clip of tape from Marty Meehan, president of the UMass system. We spoke to him actually a few weeks back about these issues around the time that the Pioneer Institute, Jim, your organization, put out a report somewhat critical of the University of Massachusetts. Here's what he said about some of the issues that you just brought up.
Yep. I wish the state would build facilities the way they do in California, the way they do in Maryland, the way they do in Pennsylvania, the way they do in Wisconsin, but they don't. The state may fund us 1 year, they may not fund us the next year, but we are headed in an upward trajectory. We want to rise in the rankings, we want to increase our stature, and we want to increase the quality of education that we provide for our students.
So, John, I'd love you to respond to this, but I mean, respond to Marty Meehan's point there that, you know, he wishes that Massachusetts would support public education like some of these other states.
Can I tell you what I wish?
Yeah.
I have a ton of wishes, but they're not going to happen. You know, as someone who teaches at a private university, I think I'll choose my words carefully here, but one of the things to look at throughout the college universe is the rise in administrative staff and administrative costs. When you look at the budget for UMass, for all five campuses, 58% of their budget goes to salaries and benefits, and a lot of that, and that's up 5%, and a lot of it goes to this sort of middle management that is growing by leaps and bounds. And middle management manages, but they don't go in the classroom. The tangible benefits are sometimes hard to discern. So I would look to that across the board. This is not just UMass. It's not just private colleges. It's colleges and universities across the board that, you know, to reexamine the necessity for that kind of bureaucracy.
What do you think? What do you think, Jim? Is that a good place to start, or to continue this effort to take a look at middle management?
It's absolutely the place to start. If you look at, I can't do this because I'm on radio, but if you look at investment instruction by UMass, it is flatlined. But if you look at administrative bloat, it's just going up incredibly fast. In the president's own office, just to give you a sense, the top 10 employees in his office make on average over $300,000. I mean, in every other state agency, it's not even close to that. The governor makes $146,000. I mean, they're just padding and padding. I would just say also, the president I respect a ton, but he's wrong on this. He's wrong in the sense that Massachusetts is number two in New England in terms of support for students. And that's not even including all the stuff the state takes on for debt service, pension benefits. We are investing in the system pretty heavily. They have a bad strategy.
All right. Well, we'll invite Marty Meehan back and continue this conversation, but I appreciate this. And gentlemen, we're going to move on because we have just enough time for our hubbubs, those stories that might not have made it to the front page but caught our attention. John, let's hear your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub is a recommendation, and that is everyone should go take a tour of Boston's public garden, which the missus and I did not long ago. It's terrific. They're Tuesday and Thursday, 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock. You meet at the Makeway for Ducklings sculpture. And they're really fascinating, and you would learn fun facts to know and tell, like Romeo and Juliet. The swans are not Romeo and Juliet. They're Juliet and Julia. That's why you never see any little swans, because even though one of them is sitting on the eggs, nothing's coming out of them. There are two redwoods, a Himalayan birch. There are all kinds of great stories. One last thing, there's a Make Way for Ducklings sculpture in Moscow, but the Russian kids cannot sit on them. So American kids really do have the greatest nation in the world.
All right, amen to that. A tour of Boston Public Garden. Jim, what's your hubbub?
Well, the kids are definitely going to the Commons, but they're not looking at it. Parents can now stop repeating, play those video games, and go outside. The zombies have left your basement. Pokemon Go has accomplished the impossible. Now the zombies are outside milling around the parks and going on this sort of treasure hunt looking for pocket monsters they can train to fight other pocket monsters. Look, there are lots of things that have come out about privacy issues around this, around dangerous people getting killed, finding dead bodies as they've searched for Pokemon everywhere. Two quick things. The first one is, this is the start of augmented reality, and people should get used to the idea. You're going to hear a lot about that. But the second thing is, who makes the games has changed. Nintendo's only getting a 10% cut on this, and Google and Niantic and all these high-tech firms are taking the rest of it. It's a sea change in how we think about who develops games.
Really interesting. All right, well, so here's my hubbub. It's just to say I'm excited about the second half of this baseball season, the gamble and the deal that the Red Sox made, trading away a young prospect, Anderson Espinosa, to Landrew Pomerantz. He may not be the best. He may not be a number one starter, but good enough to be an all-star. And as Red Sox chief baseball operations guy Dave Dombrowski said, we want to win. And if you're going to win, you have to acquire someone. You're going to have to trade someone you don't want to trade. So it's a gamble, but kind of a gutsy one. And I'm really looking forward to see how this plays out in the second part of the season, which begins tonight, John Carroll, against your New York Yankees.
Exactly. Out me again on the radio. Thank you.
On the Bronx. John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communication and a Yankees fan. Have a great weekend, John.
Thanks. You too, Anthony.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you as well. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, there's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. With the Republican National Convention set to kick off on Monday, Donald Trump made it official today. Indiana Governor Mike Pence will be his vice presidential running mate. Pence is a former congressman with strong conservative credentials. He opposes same-sex marriage, abortion rights, and immigration amnesty. He favors increased border security, expanded gun rights, and big increases in military spending. Here he is campaigning with Trump in Westfield, Indiana, earlier this week.
We're ready for a change in this state. We're ready to put a fighter, a builder, and a patriot in the Oval Office of the United States of America. We're ready for Donald Trump to be our next president.
So we're going to get reaction now from a couple of prominent New England Republicans. First with us, we're joined by Massachusetts State Representative Jeff Diehl. He's co-chair of Trump's Massachusetts presidential campaign. And Jeff Diehl, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Yeah. Anthony, thanks so much for having me on.
Also with us is Fergus Cullen. He's former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, and he joins us today from New Hampshire. Fergus, always good to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Jeff. Trump has made unpredictable a trademark of his campaign, but this seems like a pretty safe choice. What do you think about Mike Pence for vice president?
I think it's a great fit. Look, Newt Gingrich, obviously a very smart guy, been around for a long time, led the Contract for America. I think he'd make a great chief of staff. And Chris Christie, obviously, was another person in consideration. I think he'd make a great attorney general. But at this point, I think Mike Pence provides the balance that we're looking for on the ticket. Obviously, a former congressman, so he knows D.C. And at the same time, he's got the executive experience as Indiana's governor. So I think it's a perfect fit. And I think, you know, look, even though they may not be aligned perfectly on all issues, that's always a good thing to have that discussion. And at the same time, he provides that steady hand that knows government.
Sure. Now, Fergus Cullen, I come to you, and you won't mind if I disclose, you've been very much part of sort of the Never Trump movement within the Republican Party. So I'm wondering if a safe choice like Mike Pence, and with a guy with real conservative credentials, improves your view of Donald Trump's candidacy?
You know, I've got nothing against Governor Pence, and he has been a strong conservative, which is something that Donald Trump has not been throughout this process. But I guess politically, my question is, who does Mike Pence bring to the ticket in terms of voters that weren't already with Trump? I don't think he helps him in that sense. It sort of doubles down on very conservative voters. That's okay. I've got no problem necessarily with that, but it doesn't win over, especially women voters and swing voters, gettable voters around the country that Trump needs in order to win.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Jeff Diehl? You know, what question that I had is it seems like a safe choice. And someone like Newt Gingrich, I mean, he made the comment recently that if Trump had picked him, there'd be a pair of pirates on the ticket. Wouldn't that have been, I don't know, more in keeping with Trump's brash shake up the establishment image, or speak to Fergus's point about, you know, how does this sort of expand the folks, the pool of people who are supporting Trump?
Well, one thing is I think Donald Trump is already fitting in with the Northeast area. You know, Fergus maybe is an exception. But I think what Mike Pence brings is a big swath of the heartland, the Midwest area that may be reluctant to come to him. As far as attracting, you know, people that wouldn't vote for Donald Trump, I think actually, you know, again, Mike Pence brings the conservatives that maybe were still reluctant. Again, there is sort of a Never Trump group still out there. But at the same time, Donald Trump himself has brought millions of new voters to the Republican primary. In Massachusetts, as you know, 20,000 Democrats unenrolled in order to vote for Donald Trump. And in Pennsylvania, a state he's now leading in, 90,000 Democrats unenrolled. So I think Donald Trump himself is the person that's bringing new people to the party. And Mike Pence solidifies the base.
So what about that, Fergus? I mean, I'm thinking about this point that Jeff made, this idea of solidifying the base. I mean, one of the concerns that I know the Republican Party establishment has as we move toward the convention is, you know, there's some concern around how volatile Trump is. And this seems to sort of allow him to make a case that, no, I can be sober, I can make a safe choice. And Mike Pence is evidence of that.
Well, I wish I could agree with that a little more strongly. But, you know, the process by which Pence was selected reminds me of Jeb Bush's criticism of Trump being the chaos candidate. And just this afternoon, we have allegedly high members of his staff leaking to reporters that Trump was having second doubts as late as midnight last night about whether, you know, could he get out of this pick. And that's some of the concern. You know, just because he's been on good behavior and stayed off of Twitter last weekend doesn't mean that he's not going to go off the rails again tomorrow. So, you know, the Trump campaign may have succeeded in defeating the Free the Delegates movement, which I supported, but they haven't stopped the Stop Trump or Never Trump movement. And the fact that we're this late into the process and they're still having trouble even solidifying the Republican base should be worrisome politically to their long-term prospects.
Jeff D., I'd love to get your response, your reaction to that.
Well, one of the things, too, I think coming into this was there was a split of Ron Paul folks from the past that a lot went to Donald Trump, a lot went to Ted Cruz. And those, you know, again, have been some people that were reluctant to see on the Cruz side Donald Trump as the nominee. Look, Ted Cruz is actually coming to the convention and speaking, and my guess is that he'll be supporting Donald Trump for the run. I think that that coming out of the convention will be a big help in trying to bring, you know, the last sort of remnants of people against Donald Trump, you know, the conservative, constitutional conservatives into the fold. And I really think this convention is going to be a great chance to have a lot of new folks that have become part of the political process, not your typical legislators, you know, showing up. And that is going to spread across the country when they go back to their states and let them know what Donald Trump's all about. I really look forward to it. And I think Mike Pence really helps solidify that again.
Well, Jeff, I know you're on your way to Cleveland right now. Fergus, Jeff was talking about sort of what he's expecting and looking forward to in the convention, which kicks off on Monday, the RNC. What will you be watching for?
Well, I hope it's a party that I recognize as my own. And, you know, that's a concern a lot of us longtime members of the party have. You know, Trump has won the nomination fair and square. I give him that. Some of us are concerned about the image he's going to present as Republicans for the next 4 months and what effect that might have on down ballot candidates. You know, we'll see if he's just borrowing the party for 4 months or if it's going to be, you know, the start of something long term in terms of repositioning the party. I suspect it's going to end with him renting the party for 4 months, and some of us are going to have to be around after November to pick up the pieces.
All right, well, that's Fergus Cullen. He's former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party and now principal of Fergus Cullen Communications. Fergus, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony. Good luck, Jeff.
Also with us, State Representative Jeff Diehl, co-chair of Trump's Massachusetts presidential campaign. He's on his way to Cleveland for the RNC, which kicks off on Monday. Jeff Diehl, safe travels, and thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Anthony, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thank you, Fergus, too.
All right, listeners, stay with us. Still ahead, Life Animated, Ron Suskind's incredible story of how Disney characters provided the key for his severely autistic son to rejoin his family and the world. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Ron Suskind has an extraordinary story to tell about his son, Owen, who was diagnosed with autism just shy of his third birthday. For the first 3 years of his life, Owen was a typical, happy toddler who suddenly fell silent. A diagnosis of regressive autism follows, which affects about a third of children with autism spectrum disorders. Little Owen stopped talking. He retreated into himself. But he retained a passion for Disney movies, their stories, characters, and their language, which eventually provided the key that allowed him to re-engage with his family and the world. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind wrote about Owen's journey in his book Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. It's now the subject of a new documentary film, which has its Boston area premiere tonight at the Kendall Square Cinema in Cambridge. We spoke with Ron Suskind after his book came out 2 years ago. It's a powerful story, which we wanted to revisit today. I began by asking Ron what Owen was like before he was diagnosed with regressive autism.
Before his diagnosis, he's chatting away at two and a half, usual few hundred word vocabulary of a 2.5-year-old. We moved to Washington. I was working at the Wall Street Journal, and that's when all of a sudden he starts to lose function, ability. And after 3 months in Washington, he's down to one word. Juice was his only word. And he was drinking at that point from a sippy cup. He graduated to the big boy cup about 1.5 years before, but he was back to the baby cup. And at that point, Cornelia and I said, we need to see a specialist. And that's when we heard autism for the first time.
And so what did hearing that word do to you? I mean, how did you respond?
Well, it's you can almost do a before and after. You know, I can see those two people, Cornelia and me sitting on the chair when we hear it for the first time. And then we seem to escape from our bodies and look down on those two people frozen in place. And the doctors explained to us, look, some kids never get their speech back. You have to be aware of that. This is a life journey you're now embarking on. You've got to think about supporting them for the next 50 years and for 30 years after you're dead. This is an adult moment.
Yeah. As you say, many people with this diagnosis never get their speech back. But here's Owen, who retains this passion for Disney films, which he watched with his older brother, Walt. So tell us what happened one day in November of 1994 when you and your wife are watching The Little Mermaid with him, and he begins to say something you're not sure what.
Yeah, well, he's been murmuring a phrase, juicervos, for a few months. Now, he's not speaking at this point, and so we can't make sense of it. And then we're watching The Little Mermaid. And there's a moment, I think many people have seen this movie, where Ariel, the protagonist, wants to become human. Ursula, the sea witch, says there will be a price. It won't cost you much. A trifle, really, just your voice. Owen's rewinding that part. Second, third rewind, Cornelia all of a sudden says it's not juice. It's just your voice. He's saying just your voice. I grab Owen. I say just your voice. He's saying juicervos. We thought this was the moment of breakthrough. It's the first time he really looks at me in a year because, you know, the gaze aversion is part of autism. And we jump up and down in the bed. Walter's saying, Owen's talking again. We go to our doctors, though, a week or two later, and they say, let's sit down. Let's discuss this. This is called echolalia. Many folks who lose the ability to speak, or auditory processing, or process what they hear, they mimic sounds, just like a parrot.
So it's echo. So they're echoing what they hear.
Just like what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And that goes on for years, where we hear phrases bubbling up. You know, booty lies within was the next year. That's beauty lies within. But still, we don't know if he's understanding or what he's understanding. Now, meanwhile, Cornelia's working round the clock. You know, every day, every night, Owen is not sleeping, so she's up every night with him. Every therapist we can find. A little bit of speech is coming back, 2-3-word sentences. And then when he's about 6 and a half, you know, his brother gets a little emotional on his birthday. He's 9 years old, his older brother, Walt, and Owen walks in to the kitchen on the day of Walt's birthday and says Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. Now, this is his first real sentence at 6 and a half.
Walter doesn't want to grow up. So he's really he's really interpreting something here. He can't just be sort of mimicking words.
Yeah, well, that was the moment we said, oh, my God, there's a world in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, people who know these movies, it's like Aladdin in the Cave of Wonders. It's like that giant head emerges from the sand and then disappears back. So the question was, how do you get back in? And really, our challenge was to get back in that stretched across years. At that point, we start to play out scenes from movies. We realized that he had memorized them, whether he understood them or not, he had the sounds down, like putting down tracks of music.
Right.
And if you threw him a line, he'd throw you back the next line, and you threw him the next, and he'd throw back the next.
We have a clip to play, Ron. This is from a documentary that Roger Ross Williams just began filming about your family. And here you are talking to Owen about that really pivotal moment in your relationship with him when he was 6 and a half. You pick up a puppet of the character Iago, which is the parrot from Aladdin.
Yeah, the sidekick to the villain Jafar.
Sidekick, right, who's voiced by Gilbert Gottfried. But here we're going to hear you talking about that moment with your son, Owen. It's a brief clip, but let's listen.
Owen does Gilbert Gottfried better than I do, but I had to do Gilbert. So I say, Owen, wait a minute. How does it feel to be you?
I ain't lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah. You know, and that was the first time we had a conversation, really, you and me, since you're about 2.
Yeah.
Incredibly powerful moment there. So take us back to that day. And you know, he actually said that, I'm lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah.
He's channeling Disney there, but boy, he seems to be communicating something real about himself.
Well, the key was after that night, after Owen says about Mowgli or Peter Pan, I went up to his room and I put on the puppet and I talked to him as Iago, the puppet. And that is the moment where he turns to Iago like bumping into an old friend and he speaks back in a voice that I had never really heard. At that point, our house went into a kind of insanity,
right,
a lovely insanity in its way, where we said, look, we just have to play out all the parts of these movies we can find. So we start what we call the basement sessions, where Cornelia and I and Walt, his older brother, and of course Owen, start playing out scenes from movies. And Owen had memorized about 20 of the Disney movies. Again, this is the thing a lot of these kids do. It's actually called scripting by some of the therapists. They memorize the words, the scripts, and we played them out. And the key was he not only give you back the line from Mowgli, let's say, or from Arthur, or from Simba, he would emote through the words, and that made us feel he understood what he was saying. And over years, he began to understand it. That was clear.
So what happened? How did Disney, this Disney material, help him do that? What's the theory there?
Well, the theory is a couple of things. First off, plain and simple, Walt Disney takes these iconic tales that go back thousands of years, just like the Brothers Grimm did. These are part of folklore, the stories we told ourselves to make our way in the world.
Yeah.
And so they're iconic stories full of emotion. Now, Disney, when he begins this era of animation in the 30s, he says to the animators, I want these things to be so vivid to the eye, the expressions, the situations, that you can understand them without the sound on. Now, what could be better? Now, you get to the 80s, another clear twist, just an oddity, is that at that point, the VCR arrives at domestic home use. People pretty much all had VCRs by the mid-80s. The key is autistic spectrum kids could then rewind the tapes. Before that, you had to go to the movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, that was over. It was the era in which images could be part of a free feed. And this creates a change because they could rewind them over and over again and so-called hyper-systemize them. That's actually the neuroscientist term, to go deeper and deeper, to understand what was happening, to dig into new details, to meditate over the interaction of characters. And that's the way many of them, not just Owen, many of them had found a way to make sense of complex reality. It's almost like one of the neuroscientists, because many neuroscientists are now studying this called affinity therapy. That's the idea. Cornelia and I had to give it a name. That's what we called it. And they're finding that they're using their affinity almost like the Enigma machine in World War II, the code breaker, to break the code of the wider world. They turn the affinity into a toolkit, navigational equipment, and a language that ultimately ends up being a thing of high utility.
I want to just ask you this. I mean, this is an astonishing story, and we're going to talk a little bit about how Owen is doing today, and he's doing much, 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 much better than he was, though it's not all sort of, and he lived happily ever after, and we'll get to that. But what's the lesson for the broader community that is dealing with this challenge?
Well, I think it's that it's looking at a blind spot that a lot of us so-called neurotypical people do. That is just the term of art for normal. I'm not sure what that term means, frankly, anymore.
Sure.
I think we're all on various spectrums. I think we're recognizing that now. But what we did was say, be more like us. You know, jump around between subjects, you know, listen to what the teacher's saying.
Learn
and send it
like
back.
Us, talk like
exactly.
us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to be the way. But because we felt that way, these affinities were seen as perseverative and obsessive, cut them off, wean the kids off them. Now the view, since the book came out, is that they're more pathway than prison. And if you go deep into them, live inside of them with the kid, you'll find that down there in that underground cavern, each of these kids seems to have one of these. There's navigation equipment. There's language that means this and that. There are ways that the kids are processing it to understand themselves. And eventually, as what happened with Owen, and we have it happening with other families that call us, we created a vehicle that he now drives out into the world. That is something that he's in charge of, because this affinity is deeply rooted in him. And, you know, look, the fact is, it's the idea is that the DNA of all things is found in everything. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the lesson. Let them be more like themselves rather than more like us.
Let me introduce Walt Suskind. And Ron, of course, this is your older son. He graduated from college in 2011. He's now a public affairs specialist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. He joins us from NPR in Washington. And Walt, good to have you and good to meet you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for doing this. I wondered if I could talk to you about this really interesting double life that was created in your household. I mean, your dad's going off and working at the Wall Street Journal as a reporter. You're going off, if I have this right, to a prep school during the day. Then you come home to your family and to Owen at the end of the day, and you're all engaged in this kind of Disney therapy to reach him. What was that like for you?
It was something that, for the most part, definitely stayed in the house. Being a fifth grader.
I'm only laughing because your dad's sitting across the table and laughing.
Don't
too,
bring this
so
out. Well, Walt, you
so
remember.
It's infectious.
Sometimes it would bleed out of the house, though. You remember that, right?
It definitely would, but I'll say as a fifth grader, you're not getting a lot of social currency telling people you're watching the Jungle Book down in the basement with your little brother and parents. But right. It was. You know, that was our camp. That was our campfire that we gathered around.
Ron, you describe Walt at one point in the book as a junior adult at age 7.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, Walt was always kind of a tough, independent kid from the very start. Talked to adults. He would make his way in any situation. And by the time Walt gets to be about 7 or 8, we're sitting him down and saying, well, obviously your brother's a little different. And, of course, Walt realizes this almost before we do at the very instant when it's happening. And at the same time, we probably didn't recognize the struggles that Walt had trying to navigate this double life. There was a story in the book where Walt going to the first day of first grade at a new school, 5 blocks from the school, he tells Cornelia, let me out here, I'm fine.
Oh boy.
And Cornelia's like, Walt, this isn't Dickens, they know you have parents. And he's like, no, I'm good, out he goes. Well, we use that as part of Walt junior adult, you know.
Yeah.
And he rode his bike to school on his own too. Well, Walt later explains to us, when I had to report this book with my son, which was sometimes a little uncomfortable, he says, look, it was just me, Owen, and Mom in the car, and if Mom brought Owen in, bringing me in, everyone would see what Owen was up to, and sixth grade boys can be a cruel bunch. That was the reality. That Walt worked his way through quite powerfully and admirably, which is a big part of what's often so evocative that readers are seeing in the book.
Walt, how do you sort of articulate or recall, for instance, that episode of getting close to school and saying, Mom, this is good enough, I'll take it from here?
Absolutely. It was pretty much like my dad described it. It was tough. I mean, when Owen was in public with us, kids would laugh, kids would point, and being, you know, 7 or 8 years old, you know, I couldn't go long form and tell him about that Owen was autistic and this and that and neurological differences, and you just kind of don't know what to do, and you want to protect your little brother at all costs. And yeah, basically my calculation was if kids wouldn't see him, then they couldn't make fun of him.
Ron, I need to ask you, and this is a sort of crucial part of the story, how is Owen doing now?
Well, Owen is at a school out in Cape Cod. It's a school for folks, some are in the autism spectrum, other kids with different kinds of challenges. He'll be graduating in 2 weeks after 3 years there. And it's been a great time there for him. As soon as he got there, he started Disney Club, of course, to meet people like him, he says, and to find answers, kind of whatever that means. And first year, there's 12 kids. Now there's 35 kids in it, and they all speak Disney. As well as they do that and meditate on it like philosophers, little social connections are forming in Disney Club. Several boyfriend-girlfriend mixes, including Owen.
You know, Ron, as our time winds down, I sort of want to get a couple of sort of final ideas from you. And early in the book, you write about watching Owen in a class at a special needs school in Maryland. This is not long after his diagnosis. And this is a pretty dark scene. You're reflecting on the dreams many parents have for their young children, that their kids could be presidents, Nobel Prize winners, or just graduates of fine colleges. But as you watch Owen spinning around, murmuring to himself at that point in his life, you realize those dreams are going to, you know, you're smashing them in the corner in your mind. So this book represents such a sort of evolution for you, because what do you think now about these dreams for your son?
Our education begins at that moment. We're sitting there, and a Down syndrome kid in the class comes up and hugs Cornelia and I and says, I love you. You know, of course, we were just beginning our process of learning how subtle ability is, often emotional acuity, sensitivities. Kids like Owen, even Down syndrome kids, have very, very high quotients of these abilities. Even if they're difficult to measure, it doesn't mean they're not there.
Right.
And that's what we learn, the subtleties between ability and disability, and ultimately how we all find a way to express our essence. Owen is doing that now more and more. And so his dreams are now ones that are really his own.
Yeah.
He's carrying them forward in his very improvisational path. He wants to be an animator at Disney. That's is his dream, his life dream. And actually, he's closer to that kind of thing now than he ever could have imagined, I think. Ultimately, our hope is that he has an independent and self-directed life. He will always be autistic. The challenges come every 5 seconds as he makes his way in the world. But he is living the life that he's more and more choosing for himself.
That's Ron Suskind, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism, from our interview back in 2014. We also heard from his son, Walter Suskind. And the new documentary, Life Animated, is having its Boston area premiere tonight at the Kendall Square Theater. And it's going to be followed by a discussion with Ron and his family. You can get a lot more information at RadioBoston.org. And that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, peaceful weekend, and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.